All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Turning our times to good times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from the borough of Queens in New York City. It is the first day of March 2023, and I've titled today's show, How BRICS Will Impact Your Financial Future. By five BRICS, I mean the countries of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. My guests today are Bob Moriarty, who is here with me to share or to provide his ideas on today's topics, as well as anything else he might want to add, and Quentin Henning will join me in the second segment of today's show to give us an update on Irving Resources, a company I've been following for quite a few years in my newsletter, one that I like a lot. So we'll hear from Quentin in the second part of today's show. But right now, I'm really glad to tell you that Bob Moriarty is here. Bob, thanks so much for joining me again.
It's always a pleasure, Jay. Thank you.
It's always a pleasure to have you because you provide a great entertainment and lots of great insights that I know investors are eager to hear. I'd like to review the topic of today, the idea of the five BRICS and what's taking place geopolitically and globally with monetary changes that are afoot, people that are getting sick and tired of having to use the dollar. But before we get to that, perhaps just I'd like to a quick review perhaps from you, Bob, in terms of how the dollar became or really survived as the world's reserve currency once we went off the gold standard in 1971, after we went off the international gold standard, when money could be printed, seemingly endless amounts of it could be printed, at least it seemed that way for a while. Anyway, would you set the table a little bit and explain to our listeners, those who may not yet be aware of the kind of currency system that we've lived through the last several decades?
Actually, we need to go back further than that.
Okay.
We need to go back to the Greeks and the Romans, and then we need to go back to 1492 to explain it. And basically, the Greeks and the Romans set up a debt-based financial system,
right,
where if you borrowed money and you couldn't pay the interest, couldn't pay the principal, they would seize the assets that you had put up against the loan.
Mm-hmm.
And that system continued through Greece and Rome. In 1492, when Columbus came to the New World, okay, which wasn't the New World, there had been people here for centuries, the West literally took over the world's financial system. Back then it was based in Italy, later it was based in the UK. And then in 1944, when it was clear that the Allies had won World War II, they needed to set up a new monetary system. So they had a conference in Bretton Woods in New Hampshire, and they decided that the dollar would be tied to gold and every other currency would be tied to the dollar. And that made the dollar the world's reserve currency.
Right.
Now, having a world's reserve currency means like having your rich uncle's platinum American Express card, and you can spend anything you want and you never have to pay it back. So the United States has basically had a free ride since 1944. I was going to college in 1972 or 1973 at Iona College in New Rochelle, And I think I was taking a sociology course, and I did a paper on the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency. And it was laid out as 1972, 1973. The United States, with 5% of the world's population, had about 45% of the world's GDP. Now, if you think about it for a minute, the Germans and the French and the Russians and the South Africans, they were all producing things. They're hardworking people, intelligent people. But the United States was doing the bulk of the producing. And my conclusion was that could not continue. And either the currencies of the rest of the world would have to rise, the value of the dollar would have to drop. And the strange thing is, the professor wasn't particularly impressed with the paper. And he said, that's ridiculous. The United States will always be. And I thought, this is stupid. I mean, we got 5% of the world's population. I mean, we're not that different from everybody else.
Right.
But what happened on August 15th of 1971, did you happen, you're near enough my age, do you happen to remember what Nixon's speech was about?
Yeah, he was blaming the speculators for, well, gold was leaving the coffers, and he blamed the speculators for that, and he said it was a temporary, it was temporarily closing the gold window. But we would, of course, start trading, we'd have the currency backed by gold again, as I recall.
That was the most important part, but that's not what the speech was about. The speech was about putting in wage and price controls.
Oh, yes, it was about that.
Okay, remember?
Yes.
Inflation had shot up to a absurd 2 or 3%, and the government had to do something about it. So they put in wage and price controls. Oh, by the way, we're going to go off the gold standard, but who gives a damn?
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is, and here's what happens. Since 1971, it's obvious the United States gone on this incredible spending spree because they had nothing to control their spending. Okay, and that's what gold does. It keeps you relatively honest. And the rest of the countries of the world looked at it and said, what a great idea. We can spend money and we don't have to pay it back. Now then, one of the things that I say, and I swear I don't think anybody else says the same things, all debt gets paid.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a really important concept. All debt gets paid. It either gets paid by the borrower or it gets paid by the lender. And while Americans tend to focus on the size of the American deficit, the size of the American deficit is absolutely meaningless. What is meaningful is every dollar the U.S. government spends has to come from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it can come from one of three different places. It can come from taxes. We all hate taxes. And Congress is not eager to raise taxes because then they're not going to get reelected to office. Or it can come from inflation. Hey, I got a wonderful idea. We owe all this money, so we'll just make the money cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and we could pay off our debts in cheap dollars,
right,
or they could simply default, okay? But there is something mathematically true that's important for your viewers to understand. When you have a debt-based system, all money is loaned into existence,
right,
because of the fractional reserve system. So the bank loans you $50,000 or $100,000 for a home, and they literally create that. They write you a check, and it wasn't money before they wrote the check, but after they write the check, it's money,
right,
and you pay interest on it. But because you're paying interest, there is always more money owed than actually exists. So the debt grows and grows and grows and grows and eventually gets totally out of control. We're there right now.
Yes.
Now, in biblical times, they did something called the Jubilee.
Yes.
And periodically, they would write off the debt because the kings then were smart enough to realize that he didn't want farmers kicked off their farms because somebody had to produce the food.
Right.
So he said, okay, you guys were stupid and you borrowed all this money and you couldn't pay it back. You don't owe the money anymore. That's exactly what Biden wants to do with the student loan program. Mm-hmm. But what Biden hasn't bothered telling anybody is Biden really writing the student loans off? Is that what's happening?
What was that, Bob?
Okay, when Biden's talking about writing off the student loans, okay, is that an accurate way of putting it?
No, I don't think so. Someone's going to pay those loans. I mean, it's
thank you. Who pays it?
Well, we're going to pay it through inflation, probably.
No, you're going to pay it.
Yeah,
okay. we're going to transfer the debt from the people who actually incurred the debt. We're going to transfer the debt to the taxpayers who didn't incur the debt. Now, if you think about that, that's kind of a wait a minute. I think I just got screwed.
I think so.
Did get screwed. But the key is this is the debt-based system. Now, I believe an accurate number, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, I think an accurate number for the total debt in the world is $300 trillion. Are you okay with that number?
I have no idea. I know that our debt, that is the government debt, is over $30 trillion. But what about the, you know, the private sector debt and all the other debt that's out there? So I don't have any reason to doubt that, Bob. I'm pretty sure you know what you're talking about on that one.
Well, the U.S. debt, the unfunded debt, obligated to, it's something like $200 trillion.
Yes.
But my point is the debt is so high, the debt can never get paid. So you need to start discussing, okay, what do we do? How do we do it? And when we talk about an alternative financial system, such as that of the BRICS, it's very important to understand the debt-based system because it's very easy to understand. It is fatally flawed from the very first loan made. It's going to blow up. It's like picking up a balloon at a toy store and blowing into it.
Mm-hmm.
If you blow into a balloon and you keep blowing into it, what's going to happen?
You have to keep blowing into it. If you blow into it too long, it explodes.
Exactly. And a monetary system is exactly the same.
Yeah.
Okay. We're there. Okay. And the whole COVID, Antifa, BLM, electric vehicles, climate change, Ukrainian war, actually all goes back to this debt-based system where the United States wants to maintain the fiction that they've got things under control. We're very clearly the United States totally out of control. I, of course, was a pilot. You know that.
Yes.
I fired sidewinders and I fired sparrows. And we are now shooting down $20 balloons with $500,000 sidewinders. And if that isn't insanity, I don't know what is. And one thing that I'll say is that if the military radar can pick up a $20 balloon, that's actually pretty cool. Okay, that's really good. But some of this, there is so much mass hysteria going on right now. Everybody in Washington had a conniption fit over this Chinese balloon.
Yeah.
You can't control balloons, okay? Balloons go where the winds go. was it a spy balloon? Well, yeah, it probably was. But we're doing the same thing with satellites.
Of course.
And I don't think there's anything you could do with the balloon that you can't do with the satellite. So we had a conniption fit over the Chinese. sending a balloon across the United States.
Yeah.
There are balloons going across the United States, going around the world all the time. It's no big deal.
Yeah. Well, Bob, let me ask you this. You you mentioned that this we're at that breaking point. We're at that point where the balloon can't be expanded anymore. That isn't something, though, that seems to be recognized by our brilliant people that are running the Treasury and our government. At least the propaganda doesn't suggest they're aware of it. Someone who does seem to be aware of it, though, are the Russians and the Chinese and the BRICS, maybe all of them together. So that brings me back to the point of what about the BRICS? And, you know, we've had Alistair MacLeod is a frequent guest on this show, and he talks, he's talked a lot about how the Russians and the Chinese and a lot of other countries, unfriendly to the United States to a great extent, have built up their gold supplies tremendously. I understand from Alistair that the Shanghai, there is a futures exchange for oil and for gold. I further understand that the Saudis, who had been so close to the United States and had backed the dollar in a sense with oil, they called it the petrodollar, is now really warming up to the Chinese. And just the other day, Iraq decided that they weren't going to take dollars for their oil anymore. They were going to accept yuan. Now, here's the thing I want to ask you about. It seems to me that the stage is set for at least the Asian countries, those that aren't aligned with NATO, to start using some sort of a gold-backed system whereby, I mean, just think about the Saudis could sell their oil to China for yuan, take the yuan and buy gold, I guess. Is that your understanding?
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. Okay. But you said something I think it's factually incorrect. You were talking about the East. What is the B in BRICS?
What is the B? It's Brazil.
Yeah. Okay. They're not part of the East.
They're not part of what?
The East. Okay.
Okay.
They're not part of Russia, China, and India. Okay.
Right.
The real key is, and nobody wants to talk about this because we're being lied to now about everything. Nobody wants to talk about this, but there's no reason for South America to not join BRICS. And there's a lot of tremendous advantages to it. And there's something else that you're going to have a lot of complaints about this. What did China do to the United States? Why are they our enemy?
Well, I don't think that they really are our enemies. Right now, they're being blamed for aiding and abetting Russia, who is our declared
okay.
enemy.
Hang on. What did the Russians do?
The Russians, my goodness, well, haven't you heard, Bob? They have invaded the Ukraine.
Oh, okay. And the RAND study that the DOD paid for in 2019 that said, here's how you get Russia to invade Ukraine. Wait a minute. Aren't we being told the Russians are the bad guys? But
yes.
We paid for the study and then we did everything that we could do to get Russia to invade Ukraine. I don't know. What did the Russians want? Okay, what did they ask for in December of 2021?
Well, I think I would ask you, the Minsk agreement went back to 2014. Wasn't there some sort of an agreement that would keep us out of this war? Keep Russia out?
Well, it was 2016, and it was the Minsk II
right.
agreement, and that was something that the UK and France and Germany were part of,
yes.
and Ukraine agreed. Here's something very few people understand. The Donbass, okay, is Ukraine.
Yes.
It's been Ukraine. That didn't change until February of last year.
Mm-hmm.
But Donbass had been attacked and 14,000 people had been killed by the Ukrainians, and there was a small smoldering war going on,
right.
and Ukraine was losing. So they agreed to the Minsk II, and it would give relative independence to Donbass, and they could decide their own future.
Mm-hmm.
And they would stop shelling Donbass, and Crimea would be part of Russia, just as it's been since 1783. The real key is Russia's not the bad guy, and China's not the bad guy. Who gave their manufacturing in toto to China? Who handed manufacturing? Why is everything built in China today?
Right. I think in part because to perpetuate the world's reserve currency, the dollar, we had to export, we had to import more than we export to ensure there was dollar liquidity out there to own the world's reserve currency. That's my understanding, Bob. So that there was a plan to reduce our value-added jobs and industries in the United States, so that we could be net debtors globally. That's my understanding. Do you agree with that?
That's partially true. I'm not sure it's that important, but basically, the United States gave their manufacturing to China,
mm-hmm.
and to complain about China taking the manufacturing. When somebody hands it to you on a silver platter, it's not the same thing as taking it. Now, I'm not going to say China plays fair any more than the United States plays fair. However, China is not the enemy of the United States. Russia is not the enemy of the United States. And the fact is, I think there have been 510 wars since 1945, two-thirds of which were started by the United States. We're the most warlike country in all of recorded history. And that's not a good thing. If you look at Afghanistan in 20 years and spending $2.3 trillion to kill a bunch of goat herders, that was a really stupid war. The Ukrainian war could have been prevented in December of 2021 if the United States had listened to Putin, and Putin said, hey, remember this guy that used to be president in 1962, John F. Kennedy? He wanted secure borders. Yeah. And while you don't give a damn about your borders, we care about our borders.
Right.
And we don't want to have angry, nasty nuclear weapon holder enemies right on our front porch.
Right. And
30 years ago, 1991, the United States said they were not going to move the NATO an inch to the east. It's actually in writing. Well, that was 13 countries ago. So we're an exceptionally unstable time in history.
Right.
And actually, it all goes back to this debt-based system. The
right.
United States wants to maintain control of the rest of the world, because they've had control since 1944, and they don't want to give it up. But the fact is, the Chinese are very intelligent, hardworking people, and they would like to live the life Americans do. And the Russians are very intelligent, hardworking people. So they're saying, okay, if the debt-based system doesn't work, what do we need?
Right.
And they pretty much concluded, I mean, there's nothing you can actually nail down and say, okay, this is what the new financial system could look like. But they're saying we want some kind of a resource-based system. This is something Quentin Henny and I literally were talking about. You should, when you're doing the interview, you should bring it up. He and I designed a new world's reserve currency.
Oh.
And 2008 or 2009, he could send it to you. And it's all based around silver and gold. And it's silver and gold in grams, okay?
Uh-huh.
So instead of having a British pound and a French euro, you would have a British, 10-gram gold and a French 10-gram gold. And actually, the two would be interchangeable. If you go back to the 19th century, most of the countries in the world were on some kind of a monetary system based
right.
around metals.
Right.
And it was a very successful system for the longest time. The reason it fails is because governments always want to spend money they haven't got. And I remember when I was a kid, and you have to remember this too, when you reached in your pocket and you picked up a 50-cent coin, and that was money. Yeah. And you knew it was money because it was 90% silver and you could feel it. And if you didn't want to spend it, you could always hammer it with a spoon, make a ring out of it, or you could melt it and get your money back. If you reach in your pocket now, you pull out a slug, okay? And it's clearly a slug, and it clearly has no value. Now, in my view, because the debt-based system is really easy to define, and the flaws to the debt-based system are very obvious.
Right.
But a resource-based system is you can't quite define it. I believe, and it's just my opinion, that we'll go to a gold standard because it's so simple and makes so much sense. For any country that is actually producing things like right. China does, or has resources like Russia does, or Iran does, or Brazil does.
Yeah.
A resource-based system makes all the sense in the world because you're getting real value for it. I can't give you any accurate numbers, but the financial part of the U.S. GDP is something like 30% or 32%. And that's like having an Indian casino and a tattoo parlor in a small town and pretending you have an economy. That is not an economy, okay?
Yeah, right.
That's a casino and a tattoo parlor, but they don't create real value. Real value is created by digging materials out of the ground that people want or building something with
right.
it. And you know, China and Russia want to do that. And I'm all in favor. I do not see China is the enemy. And some of these things, we had a Marine Corps general six weeks ago, I think he was in Japan, who said China's a new enemy. We need to be prepared to go to war. Now, I was in a war. Do not come to me and say, Bob, we need to go defeat China. Because I would say, man, that's a big country. You're not going to defeat China. How are you going to defeat China? What are you going to do, turn it into a sheet of glass? You're not going to defeat them. No. And besides, where are we going to get all our cheap Chinese shit?
Yeah.
So we've got a situation where we're defining people as our enemies. And I think that's a terrible, terrible, terrible mistake.
Right.
I don't know where the Ukrainian stupidity is going to go, and it's about to get ratcheted up big time.
Right.
Because there's a little tiny sliver of land that's controlled by Russia that's in between Moldova and Ukraine. And there is enough ammunition and an ammo dump there to supply Ukraine for a year. And it looks like Ukraine's going to attack there. Why anyone would risk a nuclear war over bringing Ukraine into NATO? Anybody who thinks it's a good idea is clearly insane. If you have a nasty neighbor who has nuclear weapons, don't screw with him.
No.
Okay. Everybody has nasty neighbors. Okay.
But Bob, it seems to me that what we're really facing now is what President Eisenhower was worried about. He saw the growing military-industrial complex with World War II, and he recognized a potential danger to our freedom, to our liberty, because I don't think we can continue going on fighting wars like this and not lose what we were supposed to be about, what our Declaration of Independence, what our Constitution said we are about. In fact, it seems we are losing it very rapidly, and I think there's a connection between what we're doing overseas. I mean, for example, take personal liberty and spying on individuals. That was something that was reserved for foreigners until recently. when we had the FISA court, and then we basically allowed the U.S., you know, the deep state essentially to start following each of us. If they want to, they can find out anything about us that they want. They're spying on their own citizens. This is something I think was part of the what we were doing externally, we're doing now internally in the United States, it seems to me. Do you agree with that?
It's worse than that.
Yeah, how so?
Pick the president in 2020.
Right.
Who did it?
Right.
Who said this guy's going to be president?
Well, it's obviously the apparatus, the intelligence. I think it's pretty clear that it was the...
It was the CIA.
Right. And the propaganda that is part of the same complex.
And hiding the Hunter Biden laptop. If the FBI had come out, they had exposed the Hunter Biden laptop. And it's just filled with crimes.
Right.
Okay. I mean, the amazing thing is you got this crackhead who's paid for prostitutes, which happens to be illegal, smoking crack, which happens to be illegal, buying guns without filling the paperwork correctly, throwing the guns in garbage trash cans. I mean, it's my God, how did this guy do all that? And the FBI never noticed when the FBI and the CIA start picking presidents, you're in an exceptionally dangerous period in history. And and strange enough, it's not just Eisenhower that warned us about the congressional military industrial complex. MacArthur did the same thing.
Right.
And the reason was these guys had been at war and they saw America transition from a peacetime America to a wartime America, and they realized how much power had been given to the military-industrial complex. Right. And quite bluntly, the military-industrial complex and the banking system have created this cartel. Okay, the Great Reset says that by 2030, okay, you will own nothing, you will owe nothing, and you'll be happy. But of course, that's the definition of slavery. But that raises a really interesting question. Okay, if you don't own your car, you don't own your house, who does own it? Somebody's got to own it.
Yeah.
And what it's going to be, it's a 0.1%. It's going to be BlackRock, and it's going to be Amazon, and it's going to be Google.
Yeah.
And it's going to be the banking system. Okay. Wait a minute. Okay. One of the things that I know, and I'm sure you know too, when is the first time you actually had credit? A credit card or a loan, or when's the first time you personally used credit? How old were you?
Probably in my 30s, I suppose. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, but it was credit that I used to, you know, monthly and pay it back.
I went into flight training in Pensacola in 1965, and I was 18 years old. And because I was a cadet and because I was in an officer candidate program, I could walk into a car dealer there, sign a piece of paper, and get a car. And they were really cool because what they would do is they would give you a car for $50 a month, which you could afford because I was making $147.50 a month at the time. And then when you got your wings, okay, 18 months later, the price would jack up to the real price. And what I didn't understand then, but I do understand now, is when you borrow money, you have become a slave. Mm-hmm. If you owe money, you are a slave. Now, when I bought the first real estate that I ever bought, let me think, it would have been in 1972 or 1973. So it would have been 50 some years ago. They give you all these papers, and the papers say, okay, this is how much you're paying for the house, and this is how much the commission is, and this is what the interest rate is, and this is what your total payments are. And I looked at it and said, holy cow, I'm paying more money in interest than I'm paying for the house. And strange enough, it's addictive, okay? Yeah. And 18-year-old kids can get credit cards now, and the banks want to give credit cards to them, even though they know a lot of them will default, because they're turning them into slaves.
Right.
And that's not a good thing. And that, of course, is what the Chinese and the Brazilians and the Indians and South Africans and the Russians understand, is we don't want our citizens turned into slaves.
Right.
We want them to get the benefit of the work that they produce, and we want them to be happy. We don't want the banking system rich. And of course, there's going to be a giant conflict, and that's what the conflict going on right now.
Right.
I believe the military-industrial complex of COVID, BLM, Antifa, electric vehicles, climate change, Ukraine war, it's all connected.
Yeah.
Okay, they're some kind of group, and what they're trying to do, and their spirit carrier is the World Economic Forum. Their spirit carrier is saying, okay, we want you to do this, we want you to do this, we want you to do this. And some of the stuff is so insane. In the UK, they're coming up with the idea of 15-minute cities, and they will portion off cities. Everything that you need is available within 15 minutes. And you can't go outside that over a certain number of times a month. And I'm going, excuse me, you know, who thought that was a good idea?
So
now, the fatal flaw is that if the World Economic Forum is going to take over managing the world, and if all of us are going to have a social credit score, who's going to set all this stuff up? Who makes the rules? Who's under control? And the fact is, people are screwed up enough already. You don't need to make it more complicated. And the reason I like a gold-based system is when you've got a gold coin in your pocket, you have an asset. If you've got a dollar bill in your pocket, that's not an asset. That's a liability.
That's a liability. Exactly right, Bob. Well, I guess that maybe just in wrapping up then, what would you suggest? Gold has performed much better than, let's say, financial assets over the last year or so. Gold, silver. Silver has been a disappointment in the short run. But, you know, clearly the existing dollar system, they don't really like that competition, do they? They don't really like, obviously, they're not going to like what the BRICS are doing now in terms of stepping outside of the dollar, not using the dollar. It takes away the power of the United States and the NATO alliances, I suppose. Help me understand how we're going to move from this sort of liability system to an honest-based monetary system. Because you're right, gold is money, everything else, I think it was JP Morgan said, gold is money, everything else is credit. You know, silver, I guess you could throw in there as well, as a, you know, it's an asset-based money. But how do we get from where we are now on the doorstep of something very, very, very tragic, potentially, you know, we hope not nuclear war, but goodness sakes, these guys are pushing it to the brink. How do we get from where we are now to what the BRICS seem to be envisioning? And I don't want anybody to think that I think everything is perfect in China and Russia and everywhere else. Not at all do I think that. But certainly, Bob, we wouldn't have what we have now if we hadn't gone off the gold standard. All of these geopolitical, the strife that we're facing now would not have been possible, I believe, if Nixon hadn't taken us off the gold standard in the international gold standard in 71. Do you agree?
Well, here's the deal. You cannot have an honest monetary system without honest money. You
uh-huh.
cannot have an honest economy without money.
Uh-huh.
We've got this system that is so incredibly distorted. We're going to see another 1929 or worse It's already started. You could see it in the stock market. The reason I think the resource stocks are going down is because people are selling off everything they can.
Right.
But you raised a really good question. What do we do? The first thing you do is you educate yourself. And what I would highly recommend all of your viewers do, go to Amazon and buy The Fourth Turning and read the book.
Right.
And this is a book that was written 25 years ago by two absolute geniuses. And it talked about starting in 2005, you were going to go into a crisis stage and you had one or two of two possible alternatives. One alternative was to go to a totalitarian government. And if you can't see that happening right now, you're not paying any attention whatsoever.
Right.
There are so many forces in the world trying to create totalitarian governments. It's absolutely obscene. However, the other part, and everybody's pretty much ignored this, is when people educate themselves and they start doing what is in their own self-interest, is they educate themselves and they seek liberty.
Mm-hmm.
So my belief is that the World Economic Forum, the military industrial complex, the DOD, all of these, I hesitate to call leadership in the Biden administration. Mm-hmm. We have an administration filled with freaks. Okay. When you look at the defense ministers of the European Union and you look at Miley, and I want to gag. I'll give you a number that'll explain the problem very simply. In World War II, there were three capital ships for every admiral. Now there are three admirals for every capital ship. Okay. At the time of Gulf War, there were 9 four-star generals. Now there are 40.
Wow.
Now, when you look at these, and bear in mind, I was in the military, I was in combat, I got awarded 54 medals in total. So I had 2 or 3 rows of ribbons. If you look at the generals now, they've got like 30 awards, and none of them are for combat. They're all attendance awards. When I was flying in the Marine Corps, these guys had been at Guadalcanal. These guys had been at Iwo Jima. These guys had fought in Korea. They were people who understood war. And we keep getting in these stupid wars because we've got nobody in our military who has ever fought battle.
Right.
The only guy who has is Greg McGregor.
Yes.
Okay. And
yes.
He said, what you're doing is really stupid and self-destructive. But back to your question.
Yes.
People should read The Fourth Turning. They should educate themselves and they should absolutely understand there are no experts. There are no gurus. There's nobody who's going to give you a magic answer. Everybody has some kind of a vested interest. And what you're hearing is their particular vested interest. You need to look at it and say, is Russia really our enemy? Is China really our enemy? Would I donate my children to go fight a war against these people? I don't think so.
No.
I don't see any reason to do that.
Well, in particular, Bob, also because we are losing our liberties here at home. I mean, what are we fighting for, really? If, you know, we're starting to see tyranny here in the United States. And I mean, what's to fight for if you're going to go down the same road as the bloody dictators of the last century? We'll have to leave it go at that, Bob. I thank you so much. But I guess you would say then, clearly stay out of debt. That's something we should have done a long time ago. We've managed to do that, thankfully, Mrs. Taylor and I, and a lot of our friends. But own, I guess, put your wealth in real things, in gold and silver, I guess that's what we have to start with, right? And portable wealth, which is gold and silver, is a good place to start. That's where you should build your foundation on, I think, and I think you would agree with that.
I would agree with that. There's two factors. One is, as an insurance policy, and I view physical gold, physical silver as an insurance policy, period.
Right.
Okay. I don't care about the price any more than I care about the insurance policy on my car.
Right.
I can't even tell you what it costs because I don't care.
Yeah.
But once past that, you can invest in resources. Quite bluntly, resource stocks are getting especially cheap now.
Yes.
It's because of the overall market. I think there's going to be an incredible opportunity. And the future is absolutely with the BRICS. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens when Italy or Greece or France says, you know, this BRICS, maybe that's a good idea.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one thing. Seymour Hersh just showed that the United States committed the biggest, most expensive act of terrorism in history against Germany.
Yes, one of our best allies.
Think of the ramifications there. That's just utter insanity.
Yeah. Bob, we'll have to leave it go at that. I want to thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us. And it's always a pleasure having you. It's always very valuable to have you. So thank you so much for being with us. Well, folks, that is all for this segment. If you like this interview, please click the like button at the bottom of your screen and also subscribe to this channel. Don't go away though, because Dr. Quentin Henning will be with me right after the break to talk about Irving Resources. Don't go away. Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really happy to tell you that Quentin Henning is with me today to talk about Irving Resources. Quentin is a director and a technical advisor to Irving. Irving is a sponsor for today's show and is also a company that I follow closely in my newsletter, and I own shares personally in my retirement account. Before I say hello to Dr. Henning, let me tell you, the stock trades in Toronto under the symbol IRV. You can buy it in the United States, as I have, under the symbol IRVRF, 61.9 million shares, I believe is approximately the number of shares, selling recently at around 69 cents in US money, giving it a market cap of around $43 million in US funds. Thank you for joining me today, Quentin.
Thank you, Jay. It's a pleasure to do the video thing with you here.
Oh, it's always great to have you on, Quentin, and we've done so many of these over the years, and some of the most exciting companies in the space, thanks to you, have been brought to my attention. Well, Irving is exploring for gold in Japan. It's and specifically in silica-hosted gold deposits. Could you, for those that may not be familiar with this story, explain the economic advantages that come with that kind of deposit, especially in Japan?
Yeah, look, what we're looking for are epithermal veins. These are veins that form from hot spring activity. And Japan, part of the Circumpacific Ring of Fire, has a lot of hot springs. And it has for many, many, you know, millions of years now. And these hot springs, many of them generate high-grade silver-gold veins. These veins usually start, you know, at surface, like they reach surface. There's usually a hot spring pool or something. But the cracks in the ground that feed that are where the veins form. So all of the minerals that including silica and gold and silver, form in those cracks that fed the hot spring. All right. So these things can extend down into the ground for hundreds and hundreds of meters. And the veins are banded. They're nicely banded. If you ever been to a hot spring, you'll often see around the edges of the pool, like places where the minerals have deposited in fine little layers. Same kind of thing in these veins. They're just myriads of little layers of silica predominantly. And in some of those layers, you'll see little specks of darker material, which is usually the gold and silver. All right. So these high silica veins make exceptional smelter flux. Now, what is that? Well, smelters, which are basically big furnaces that roast sulfide concentrates, like for copper and zinc and lead and so forth, they, in these furnaces, they need to add silica. Silica is a flux. So it's basically an agent that helps the insulate the material while it's getting heated, but it also helps soak up a lot of the impurities out of the copper or zinc as it's being melted. But also it releases, like the silica flux, when it melts, when the silica actually heats up and melts, it releases the gold and silver, all right? Mm-hmm. So the gold and silver combine with the base metals that are being produced in the furnace, and they fall to the bottom of the furnace, right? So you end up collecting the gold and the silver in the copper, what we call matte, M-A-T-T-E. That's a product. It's basically the unrefined copper. And now what they do with that, they take those copper, that they pour it into sheets and they put them into electrolytic cells, and they refine through electrolysis, they refine the copper or zinc or whatever to a higher purity. And as they do so, the gold and the silver come out. They form a sludge at the bottom of the electrolytic tanks, and they can then further refine the gold and silver. Now, what does this mean? Well, it means you don't have to build a conventional gold mill. You know, like typically a gold mine, you build a mill and you treat the rock on site. You know, you grind it up and you might add some chemicals to it that dissolve out the gold and silver. And, you know, but then you have tailings and stuff you got to deal with. The mill costs a lot of money to build. The tailings pond has, you know, capital involved and, you know, liabilities with environmental reclamation at some point and stuff like this. But the beauty of this model, you don't have to. Okay, you mine the silica flux, you mine the vein, and you can actually sell it directly as a product. Okay, the smelters buy that material because they need that flux, and they'll pay you for the silica, but they also pay you for the gold and the silver in the rock. So it's a really elegant business model.
Yeah, you would, I guess it's common in Japan because there's so many of these smelters dotted along the coast, right? Sure. And then that's you're correct. Able to ship the ore on ships, I think, to these smelters for the most part. So your transportation costs aren't what they might be if you had to haul the stuff to a mill somewhere.
Correct.
Right. So the and I would guess permitting and all that takes a lot of time if you're going to build a mill. This is the model. I guess this is the way most of the gold has been produced from Japan over the years, if I understand.
In Japan, you know, over the past 400 years and so, you know, since the beginning of the Edo period, I would say the gold has predominantly been produced, gold and silver have been predominantly produced through smelter flux. Yes.
Yeah. Well, okay. So Irving has been operating in Japan for a few years now. Could you talk a little bit about the exploration success that the company has had so far in Japan?
Yes. Look, we started drilling in earnest before COVID. So the year before COVID, and we were going full guns and we were hitting. Like in late 2019, we drilled a series of holes up in Hokkaido at the Omu project. And one of those holes hit just innumerable quartz veins. It was a very, very good start to the program. So this Omu project, we persisted to drill through COVID, but we've had challenges trying to get drillers in and out of the country predominantly. And, you know, because of that, we had to slow down our drill story there dramatically, especially last year, but we've turned the corner now. We've bought drills and we now have drill crews, including some from South America, believe it or not, who are now operating our drills on site. So we have trained Japanese, we've got people from South America as well as Canadians all teaming up to operate and drill more prolifically this year. Okay, so we're really turning the corner. Now, the Omu project, it's up in northern Hokkaido. It's near the coast, and it has multiple targets. In fact, it's got four targets across it. There's the Omui mine site. We've had very, very high-grade veins across the Omui mine site in multiple drill holes. Those now need follow-up. We need to do systematic drilling to really, you know, augment what we know at present to start defining what we might have there. We have the Omu Center, which is a center terrace. It's one of these hot spring deposits that has high grade veins underneath. We need to do follow up drilling there to prove out those veins. Up at Hokuryo, we started drilling, I think in 2021, if I remember right. We drilled just one hole It hit veins. It hit very nice veins in an area below historic mine workings. And we did some more follow-up drilling there late last year. Those samples went in for assay right before the end of the year. And those assays should be forthwith. Okay, so we got, I think, some good numbers coming out from that. We also have a new target called Mariyama. Mariyama is what appears to be a silica pipe, a breccia pipe. Like body, and we found some pretty good silver gold values at surface at the top of the breccia pipe. So we got just a plethora of really high quality epithermal veins up at Omoot. Now the real exciting story that we're going to pursue here soon is down on the southern end of Japan. It's in Kyushu, which is a southernmost island. It's called Yamagano. This project Yamagano is about 11 kilometers from the Hishikari mine, which is really the only significant gold mine in Japan. Hishikari has been operating for about 30 years, I believe, maybe a little bit more. It's produced over 8 million ounces of gold, very high grade veins, gold, silver veins in silica. It is used for smelter flux, just like I had described. Anyway, this Yamagano project, which we've put together through firstly an option with a historic family in Japan, the Shimatsus, and staking our own tenements around that, is just one of the absolute crown jewels of exploration in Japan. It is a high quality Hishikari lookalike, and we plan to drill that later this year. Okay, so that's on the slate as well.
Yeah. Well, I remember a couple, I think it was 2021, you talked about the discovery of a buried sinter. And you were very excited about that, called it a potential game changer, and you compared it to a very prolific gold deposit, I think, in Colombia.
In Ecuador, yes.
Ecuador, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we are now drilling in that area. Okay, that's it. That's back up at Omu, so it's in Hokkaido. Because of the issues we had with drilling last year, we were not able to pursue it, drill holes in that area like we'd hoped. Okay, so we had to basically kind of take a vacation from drilling because we couldn't get people in with the visa situation, but now we can. Okay, so we just finished, we're literally like right this second finishing our first hole in that area, and we'll have some more holes drilled over the next couple of months before winter breaks up. And then once we get through mud season, which is usually April through early May, we'll start drilling again in earnest in the summertime as well. So that's a high priority for us. We're following up on that now.
Okay, and we might have some drill results anytime soon?
From Hokuriya, we have assays coming back from the holes that were drilled late last year. I would say within the next week or two, we should have some news around those results.
So we should expect a pretty aggressive drill program now that you have the drill rigs and the people that can do the work, and hopefully COVID or something akin to it doesn't come back and slam us in the face again. But we could expect a pretty aggressive drill program then compared to the last couple of years, I guess.
We will. We got a lot of work coming up this year. We bought our own rigs, as you know, and we got the people staffed up now to operate them. So yes, we anticipate a much, much speedier drill program.
So company is pretty well financed. And I think one of the things that impresses me and gives me comfort also is the ownership. I think Newmont is in there. Who else? Who are your major shareholders?
Yeah, so our two major corporate shareholders are Newmont and Sumitomo Corporation. All right, so Newmont holds just under 20% of the company. They have progressively put money in through financings over the past, three or four years, I believe now. And, we work closely with them to advance these projects. You know, Yamagano in particular will be a joint effort between us and Newmont. Now, Sumitomo has traditionally worked closely with Newmont, and they also wanted to come in on this. Now, Sumitomo Corporation is not the mining house. Okay, Sumitomo Metal Mining is the mining company. Sumitomo Corp is the finance house, but they like to come alongside companies like Newmont, especially in stories like this, as a minority participant. So their ownership, I believe, is on the order of 5% of the company. But they see the value in the smelter flux scenario. And because they do own and partially own smelters across Japan, it would be a direct benefit to them to see this succeed.
Yeah, and I believe management owns a nice chunk of shares as well.
Yes, I think collectively it's on the order of 12 or 15%, somewhere right in that. Yeah.
So, you know, relatively small share float then, with less than 70 yeah. million shares outstanding. Obviously, some great news could drive these share prices very quickly. I mean, if we ever, if people decide they finally want to own gold stocks again, I mean, you and I were talking before we started filming here that the, you know, the FANG stocks have lost 80% of their free cash flow in the last 5 years, and they're only down 35%. The gold miners, the big guys like the Newmonts, the Barricks, and the Agnew Eagles are up, you know, they're collectively have doubled their free cash flow during that time, and they're hardly up at all. So it doesn't make sense from a fundamental point of view, but then markets can stay insane longer than anybody can imagine. I think it was John Maynard Keynes who said that. Whoever said it, we know it's true because we've been watching it for quite a while, Quentin. Anything else you might like to share with us in conclusion?
Yeah, look, I remain optimistic. Look, you know, you look at commodities, they're not getting more abundant. Okay, nothing is. Okay, no. And there's a lot more people on this planet than there used to be, and all of these people are starting to, you know, enter the middle class and so forth. They want stuff. Okay, so the commodity space, while it might be a bit of a headbang at times, I think over the long haul, it is the place to be. It's going to be where it's basically the bottom of the food chain. You know, if you don't have metal, you don't have society. Okay, so people need metal.
Absolutely. All right, well, thank you so much, Quentin, for spending the time with us and giving us an update on this exciting story. Always like your work, and you're always welcome to come back on the show whenever you're available and would like to talk to us. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Jay.
All right, folks. Well, that is all for this week. If you like this program, if you like this video, hit the like button and also subscribe to this channel. Next week, I'm planning on having Michael Oliver back with us again and another guest who is yet to be determined. Until next week, goodbye and God's blessings to you.